Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You know, in life, no matter how much you are down, if you are willing to give your best and fight, you know, you can always have a fighting chance to come back.
We had to rise from the ashes.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 25th of June, these are our main stories. Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder, walks free from prison after a 14-year legal battle. Protests are taking place across Kenya against a bill that would introduce new taxes. Some have entered the parliament buildings in Nairobi. And Israel's Supreme Court orders ultra-Orthodox Jewish religious students can no longer avoid being drafted into the military. Also in this podcast.
This is the successful completion of a 53-day mission to the moon to collect a sample and bring it back. And this is not just any sample.
Find out why scientists are so excited by pieces of rock and dirt taken from the far side of the moon. For some, the founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, is a hero of free speech. To others, he's a villain who endangered the lives of soldiers around the world by exposing secrets about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's been involved in a long-running saga with the United States, who wanted to put him on trial for divulging military secrets. But after a 14-year legal battle, Mr. Assange is on his way to freedom. He's been released on bail from a British prison after reaching a plea deal that ends his long fight against extradition to the United States. Mr. Assange is set to appear before a court in a remote US Pacific territory where he's expected to plead guilty to violating espionage law. He's unlikely to serve further time in prison. After his court appearance, the Australian citizen will then go on to Australia where his wife, Stella Assange, is waiting for him.
It's a whirlwind of emotions. I mean, I'm just elated. Feels like it's not real. We weren't really sure until the last 24 hours that it was actually happening. And we were talking about, I don't know, what he needed to do and take from his cell. And I also had to pack things up and head out to Australia 24 hours before he left. So it's just been nonstop for the past, I think, 72 hours.
Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says it's time for Julian Assange to return home.
Regardless of the views that people have about Mr. Assange's activities, the case has dragged on for too long. Yeah. There's nothing to be gained by his continued incarceration, and we want him brought home to Australia. And we have engaged and advocated Australia's interests using all appropriate channels to support a positive outcome, and I've done that since very early on in my prime ministership.
Julian Assange's standoff with the United States has never been a straightforward one. He spent 7 years taking refuge inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London and at one point started an unlikely friendship with the actress Pamela Anderson. Our diplomatic correspondent Caroline Horney has been following this story from the beginning.
If we look at where it first began, it was 2010 when Julian Assange's WikiLeaks published footage that showed a helicopter gunship shooting Iraqi civilians. Now, that had been obtained illegally, the US said. Followed after that, the biggest leak of US military secrets in history. So then there was an international arrest warrant in a completely separate case from Sweden. And this is how his legal issues began. There were two Swedish women who accused him of sexual assault. Now, he fought extradition to Sweden. He then went into the Ecuadorian embassy in 2012. You may remember there was round-the-clock policing at the time. So a large cost to the British taxpayer. Then 2019, he'd outstayed his welcome. Then the extradition from the US came in, and then he spent the last 5 years in Belmarsh jail. So we've been following the legal twists and turns for many years. It's hard to believe that it's finally come to an end, but certainly it seems that a deal, we don't yet know exactly how it was reached, has been reached. The Australians were pushing very, very hard for it. Joe Biden said in April that he was considering dropping the prosecution. This seems to be a compromise that suits everyone. Julian Assange wanted to be free. His health was failing. Mm. The Americans probably don't want to prosecute this now. And the Australians wanted him back.
So what happens next? I spoke to our correspondent in Sydney, Katie Watson.
So he will attend a US court, 9 o'clock Australian time on Wednesday morning. He will be attending a court in, and this is the bit of a curveball, Northern Mariana Islands on Saipan, and that's in the middle of Pacific. It's US territory, and the reason he's there is because he's nervous about going on US soil. It's also relatively close to Australia, and according to documents, that is where he's headed after entering into a guilty plea in the court in the Northern Mariana Islands.
Now, he is an Australian citizen. What would you say is the range of feelings regarding Julian Assange there, from the military all the way down to ordinary people?
Well, I think Anthony Albanese has said it earlier, and that's something that he has talked about repeatedly in the White House. On a visit to the White House in October, he also brought the subject of Julian Assange up. It's taken delegations across the political spectrum going to Washington, again lobbying with US lawmakers, the Department of Justice, to say that he needs to come back to Australia. So I think the overwhelming feeling from the news that's come out is cautious optimism that this is a man who has been imprisoned for a long time. And again, regardless of whether you believe he was a journalist doing his job or whether he was endangering lives, as the US has always maintained, he needs to be back in Australia because he's an Australian citizen.
Katie Watson. To Kenya now, where tensions are rising. That is the sound of protesters outside Parliament buildings in Nairobi. You can hear what appears to be shots of some kind as the police try to disperse the crowd. The demonstrations are against tax rises being debated there today. It is a continuation of protests that took place last week, where two people were killed and 100 arrested. These protesters explained why they joined the demonstrations.
They are collecting taxes. We as the people of Kenya have no problem with paying taxes, but we want to see what the value of our money is doing. We don't want to see a poor politician. They just walked on foot the other day. Today is putting on a watch worth 20 million. They are putting on shoes worth 500,000. And the people are dying on the street.
As a country, we are not heard. It's like we just elected leaders and they don't serve us. They just have their own personal interests. So our presence here is very important at this time and age so that we can speak on behalf of our country. We are protected by the Constitution. We have a right to picket and we are here and we are going to speak on behalf of the young people.
A short time ago, I spoke to our correspondent in Nairobi, Mercy Juma.
I am right now at a church. It's called the All Saints Cathedral, and it's just outside the Nairobi Central Business District. And I just arrived here because there's a group of medical practitioners, doctors that have set tent here, and I am seeing people being wheeled into this facility. There's one that has just passed me right now with a gunshot wound, and I don't know if you can hear that, but even where I am standing, we can hear, you know, tear gas canisters being lodged at people. We have seen and heard gunshots being fired, and seen several people lying down on the streets just outside Parliament because protesters have actually managed to breach all the security barricades that had been set up by the police and move. They are right outside Parliament now and they are threatening to now go into Parliament.
What can you see from where you are standing? Because pictures I'm looking at show what appears to be one of the parliamentary buildings on fire. Mm-hmm. We are getting reports from the Reuters news agency of the bodies of five protesters seen outside the Kenyan Parliament. It's all quite difficult to corroborate at the moment. But from what you're saying, it seems clear that the police are using live fire, and then at least one person has been injured.
Yes, the police are using live bullets. I have been able to confirm that because we have picked and we have seen protesters picking the canisters and the shells from the bullets. And we have also seen people lying down right outside Parliament. A few minutes ago, we were at a vantage position just on the Nairobi Expressway, and we could clearly see what is happening on the other side. You can hear ambulances on the background. These are people being ferried from the places where gunshots are going on into places like where I am right now, just outside town in a church where medics have set camp.
That was Mercy Juma in Nairobi. And within the last half hour, medics in Kenya say that several people have been shot dead by police during those protests. More on later editions of the Global News podcast. Now, whilst many Israelis have been mobilised to serve in the armed forces since the Gaza conflict began, there is a group who until now have been exempt from fighting: ultra-Orthodox Jewish seminary students. Now, though, the Supreme Court says they can no longer avoid being drafted, and it could have ramifications for the Israeli government. I spoke to our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yolan Nell.
In Israel, the military is often described as the people's army. Most Israelis are required by law to serve in it. But there's been this long time waiver, really, since the foundation of the state, from conscription for ultra-Orthodox Jewish men who are studying in religious seminaries. And that has long been a point of contention. It's become much more pressing because of the strain on the armed forces caused by the war that's going on in Gaza. The court referred to that in its decision, where it said, basically, in this unanimous ruling, that ultra-Orthodox Jewish seminary students had to be drafted to the military. This is a landmark case, and the justices referred to the fact that in the midst of a grueling war, the burden of inequality is harsher than ever and demands a solution. And there was another line widely quoted in the Israeli media. It said, "Discrimination regarding the most precious thing of all, life itself, is of the worst kind."
So, Yolan, what are the practical implications of this in the short term?
Well, there are tens of thousands. The data seen by the court suggested some 63,000 yeshiva students had been covered by this waiver. So potentially now many of those could be called up to serve in the army. Of course, that will require some changes in the military itself. There have been small numbers of ultra-Orthodox men that have been integrated in the past in special units. There have also been a number of people who have volunteered to be conscripted since the start of the war because, you know, the country is really seen as reeling from those deadly 7th of October attacks. But this is going to be something that is opposed by a great number of ultra-Orthodox men. It's something that will really change their lifestyle because many of them are dedicated to religious Torah study. And it remains to be seen exactly what will happen, but this will also have political shockwaves because Israel's governing coalition relies on the support of ultra-Orthodox Jewish parties. This is such an important issue for them. Really, they had been hoping that the government would come up with a new law that would have allowed the exemption to continue.
Yolan Nell in Jerusalem. Now to soldiers in Ukraine, where many of those serving on the front line are openly gay and challenging people's prejudices. Ukraine is a country where many still hold socially conservative and even homophobic views, but the war has exposed an inequality. Gay couples cannot get married in Ukraine. And that means when these soldiers are killed, their partners don't have the right to decide what happens to their bodies. LGBT campaigners are now fighting for full equality, as our correspondent Jean McKenzie reports from Kyiv.
A sea of small blue and yellow flags cover part of the main Maidan Square in the centre of Kyiv. They commemorate the fallen soldiers. But today, a group of people from the LGBT community have come to lay a different flag. These ones have a unicorn in their centre, and they are to represent each of the gay soldiers that have been killed in this war. One of those laying a flag just now is Rodion. His former partner was killed in the very early months of the full-scale invasion.
Roma was, I think, like one of the best people, you know.
The deaths of gay soldiers on the front line has exposed an injustice here. LGBT people don't have equal rights. They can't get married. which means if they're killed, their partners aren't entitled to collect their bodies.
All these deaths, all this blood, the same, no matter it's heterosexual people or homosexual people.
How has Roman's death caused you to reflect on your rights here in Ukraine?
I don't want to feel like I'm like one of half citizen. Like I pay the same tax, I'm the same pro-Ukrainian, yes, and rocket can kill me the same way like everybody else. And it's terrifying. It is our reality.
The air raid siren going off now.
Yes. Hate Russia.
People have turned out today in the pouring rain for the first gay pride march that has been held in Kyiv since the start of the full-scale invasion. The past two were cancelled because of security reasons. This one has been allowed to go ahead today, but it looks very different to the march that was held in 2021 before the war, when there was 10,000 people on the streets. Only 500 people have been allowed to gather today. Military campaigners are using this march to back a new bill which would allow same-sex partnerships. Around a dozen soldiers are here in their military uniforms. And for some of them, this is their first ever Pride March. It is the first time that they have come out so publicly. When did you come out? Today? Oh, congratulations, guys. The couple don't want to give their names, but one of them tells me he's a combat medic and he was injured on the front line 2 weeks ago. Why is this bill so important to you? Why is it important that you are able to have a civil partnership?
I'm serving on the front line and my life is always in danger. I don't know what will happen to me 1 minute to the next. If, God forbid, I were to die, my beloved partner could say he was my family and come for me.
Victor, you were the first openly gay soldier in the Ukrainian army, and you have since done so much to raise people's awareness of gay soldiers serving on the front line.
We achieved change of people's attitude towards LGBT community. We showed that there are LGBT defenders on the front line, and Ukrainians respect that. They became more inclusive towards LGBT community.
How has society changed? What have you seen?
Yeah, I remember first marches for equality. They were attacked aggressively. But every year, people became more and more inclusive.
Jean McKenzie with that report. You're listening to the Global News Podcast with me, Nick Miles. Still to come.
A converted industrial building in Berlin, home to a podcast studio called Undone.
We are Legion.
How German podcasters used artificial intelligence to find a suspected criminal who'd been on the run for 30 years. China's lunar probe, the Chang'e 6, has returned back to Earth, carrying very important cargo, the first rock and soil samples ever gathered from the far side of the moon. Here's the moment the capsule landed in the province of Inner Mongolia, captured on Chinese state media's live stream.
We're expecting a landing anytime soon. So we're watching the descent of the returner. It's landed. You can hear applause from the ground control and command center as people watch this with breath that is bated.
So why are the scientists so thrilled with this latest development? Professor Catherine Haymans, the Astronomer Royal for Scotland, spoke to the BBC's Michelle Hussein.
It was a very exciting last few hours watching the Chang'e 6 lunar probe land in Sichuan in Inner Mongolia on the grasslands there. Huge, huge congratulations to the Chinese Space Agency. This is the successful completion of a 53-day mission to the moon to collect a sample and bring it back. And this is not just any sample. There have been 10 samples returned from the moon, but this is the first ever sample from the far side of the moon. So it's incredibly exciting to see this landing successfully this morning.
It's wonderful to hear how closely you've been following it. Now, I think you should probably explain the far side of the moon, because the moon orbits the Earth, but always with the same side facing us.
When we look up at the moon at night, we see what we call the near side of the moon. And you can see these kind of these big kind of grey regions. Some people call it the sort of the man in the moon. Now, these grey regions are called mare or sea. And we think that they were created in the past through volcanic activity, a sea of lava. Now, when the first images came back from the far side of the moon, which you can't see from Earth, you have to send a spacecraft up there. There was quite a big surprise because those mare didn't exist on the far side of the moon. Images of the far side, you can just see it sort of pockmarked with lots of different craters. And that tells us that the geological activity on the moon is very different on the near side and the far side. And it's been a big puzzle why we see those differences. And that tells us about how the moon was formed 4.5 billion years ago, we think, from a big collision with a very, very early version of the Earth that created these two different bodies. So there's lots of different theories about how it was created. But in order to test those theories, we need samples to compare what the moon is like on the near side and the far side.
Professor Catherine Heymans there. From the moon to the ocean, and the United Nations says Australia should take urgent action to save the Great Barrier Reef. The UN's cultural organisation, UNESCO, is calling on Australia to be far more ambitious in its climate change targets if it wants to protect the world's largest living structure. Coral around the world is turning white and even dying as a recent record ocean heat takes a devastating toll. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, is following the story.
Well, this is a scientific panel who prepared a series of recommendations for the World Heritage Committee, which is meeting in India next month, which is why it's done now. And it's essentially a reflection of ongoing concern by UNESCO that the Great Barrier Reef is in severe danger, particularly from bleaching events. This is when ocean water heats up because of climate change, and essentially just causes the coral to turn white. Now, there's a mass bleaching event in the Great Barrier Reef again this year, and that's the fifth time it's happened in the last 8 years. So this is why UNESCO is speaking out about it at the moment.
So UNESCO is saying Australia's got to be more ambitious. What is Australia doing at the moment to help the Great Barrier Reef?
The Australian government has pushed back somewhat against this, and essentially saying that this new Labour government came in and has essentially trying to tackle climate change in a way that previous Australian governments didn't do. So they've taken it more seriously. And ultimately, this is what will protect the Great Barrier Reef by keeping ocean temperatures to a particular level, not getting too hot. The current Labour government says it's doing that. It said it's also doing a series of local actions to try and protect the barrier reef. So, for example, making sure that any water that runs off into the sea from the land, it is free of pollutants and debris from the land. It's also banned certain types of fishing on the Great Barrier Reef. So it says it's doing both local and bigger climate change actions in order to do this, which is why it's resisted slightly a push within UNESCO to try and list the Great Barrier Reef as endangered.
Michael Bristow. Artificial intelligence is weaving its way into all aspects of modern day life. Some argue for the better, but many fear the negatives. Such is the power of AI that podcasters in Germany have used it to track down a suspected terrorist who'd been on the run for 30 years. Now, as Tim Mansell reports, the police want access to the same facial recognition software used by the journalists.
A converted industrial building in Berlin, home to a podcast studio called Undone.
We are Legion.
In 2023, Undone released a series called Legion Most Wanted.
It's Legion Most Wanted.
A listener had told them he'd met a woman who claimed to be a suspected terrorist, Daniela Kletter. Kletter had been on the run for 30 years. The Undone team decided to check their listener's story out. So, with the help of an expert, they used an AI tool to compare a picture of the woman with a picture of Daniela Cletta.
And the first software said, no, that's not the same person.
There's no match.
No, no match.
This is Patrick Stegemann, co-founder of Undone. He and the team then got the AI expert to try something else, a tool that searches the internet for possible matches.
And bang, it works like this woman, she's in Berlin.
Patrick and a colleague went to look for her, but Daniela Cletta was nowhere to be found. Imagine their astonishment when, 2 months later...
Police in Germany have arrested a former member of the far-left Red Army faction who had been on the run for 30 years, 65-year-old Daniela Cletta, who's suspected of...
The Red Army faction, also known as the Baader-Meinhof gang, was founded in 1970. In the late 80s and early 90s, it claimed responsibility for a number of prominent assassinations.
The head of West Germany's biggest bank has been murdered in a car bomb attack. A left-wing terrorist group, the Red Army faction, is thought to be responsible. Alfred Herrhausen was head of the Deutsche Bank and an advisor to Chancellor Kohl.
Wir hatten einen vertraulichen Hinweis bekommen hier.
The police chief, Friedo de Vries, says the arrest of Daniela Cletta came after they were tipped off by a member of the public, not by the podcast. In fact, the police aren't allowed to use the software used by the podcast makers. But Friedo de Vries says that needs to change.
Das, was uns weiterbringen würde, und das ist,
what would help us and what we need in 2024 is to be able to compare photos that we've got with photos on the internet. I think we need to have that discussion that we should be allowed to search for people online beyond our own police databases using artificial intelligence.
The main opposition party in Germany, the CDU, agrees. In a document submitted to Parliament, it says the Cletta case highlights an urgent need to change the law.
It's the end of May and there's a big conference going on for the next 3 days here in Berlin. It's called Republika. And as one person's told me, it's a gathering of everybody who's important in the digital community in Germany.
Are you Teresa?
I'm Teresa, yes.
Hello, how are you?
Teresa Wiglock is the chairman of LODE. That's the Association for Liberal Internet Policy in Germany. She's unimpressed by the argument that the law needs to change.
The dangers are to everyone's civil liberties. And what we as LODE always say is not everything that could be done should be done by the police.
If the police had had access to the software we're talking about, perhaps they would have found Daniela Cletta significantly sooner than they did.
Yeah, maybe. But police shouldn't be striving for being faster than criminals, but for being more decent than criminals.
And you can hear more on this story in this week's assignment, Germany's AI Detectives, on the BBC World Service and on BBC Sounds. And let's finish with a classic sporting underdog story. While much of the world's attention is on football's European Championship in Germany, Afghanistan has just clinched an unlikely semi-final berth in cricket's 2020 World Cup in the Caribbean. A win against Bangladesh secured the country's first ever semi-final appearance and also knocked the highly fancied Australian side out, sparking celebrations across the country. Afghanistan's captain Rashid Khan spoke to reporters after the dramatic 8-run victory over Bangladesh in St. Vincent.
Well, I don't know how to describe my feeling. It's a big achievement for us being in the semi-finals, and I think the cricket we have played in the whole tournament so far, I think like we deserve to be in the semis, and the way everyone took the responsibility of getting into the game and performing best for the team. So I don't know how I can describe my feeling, but yeah, it's massive achievement for us as a team and as a nation to be in the semis, and now looking forward to the semis.
Afghanistan will now play South Africa in the semi-finals, while in the other match, England will meet India. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Sholata Tojimska, and the producer was Sean Wales. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.